Hello, everyone, and welcome again to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. Each week, we bring you exciting new guests to talk about various aspects of UFOs and the paranormal. And tonight, I'm really excited about our guest tonight. You know, some people might not classify this subject as paranormal, and unfortunately, it has been relegated to that field to some extent. But the truth is, if you look into this subject that we're going to be discussing tonight, it is actually has an enormous amount of evidence in support of this phenomenon, which is Bigfoot, actually, Sasquatch, also known as a Sasquatch, and many, many other names throughout the world. Our guest tonight is David Paulides, and he is the executive director of an organization known as North America Bigfoot Search. I think what differentiates this organization from a lot of others is their professionalism. They're very committed to maintaining scientific principles in all aspects of their research. They are a very seasoned group of researchers and investigators who approach this from a very scientific angle. They've spent countless hours out there in the wilderness gathering evidence in support of Bigfoot, trying to figure out whether or not the reports that are coming in do indicate that a very large primate of some type inhabits the wilderness areas of our planet. It turns out that Northern California is one of the hot spots in the world in terms of numbers of reports and sightings coming in. And many investigators believe that this area does contain the largest population of the alleged Bigfoot. So that is what we're going to be talking about tonight. I'm very excited. Our guest, David Paulides, has actually written a couple of books on this subject, including The Hoopa Project and also Tribal Bigfoot. So we're definitely talking with a very professional investigator and someone who's become one of the leaders, actually, in this field, which is, I think, just going to continue to expand as more and more evidence grows and mounts that Bigfoot is, in fact, real. So I want you all to give a nice, warm welcome to our guest, the executive director of the North America Bigfoot Search, David Paulides. David, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Wow, Preston, you put some pretty big shoes in front of me for me to fill. This is going to be a big task.
Well, I know you're up to it. You know, I've talked to you several times, and I've visited your website, and looking forward to reading your books. And so I'm really excited to talk with you tonight because, like I said, I mean, there's a lot of people out there researching this stuff, and there's certainly not everyone is out there who's doing research really has the credentials to do it or kind of does shoddy investigations. And so I'm really excited because I think there's a misconception out there about the amount of evidence out there that's in support of the existence of this creature.
You know, I think a lot of people don't spend the time, as we've done, understanding the mountain of evidence that's there. And then putting it in an organized fashion so that you can look at it, understand it, and make some sense of it. But over the years, there's probably over 100 different organizations across North America that claim to be doing research on this. And one of the first things we did as a group was try to understand the landscape of the researchers. And there's a lot of people that have done a lot of good things, but the reality of it is majority of these people just go out on weekends and they try to have a sighting or they just are out having fun, and that's a great thing. But there's not a lot that have really placed an emphasis on doing critical research at a professional level and engaging the right people to help you. And that's one of the things that we, from the very beginning, decided that we would do this. We would hold ourselves to a very high standard. We wouldn't get involved in the minutiae that some of these other groups have been in with footprints and tracks and et cetera. But what we would do is we would take everything in its entirety and try to make some common sense of it and then march forward in an organized path to prove at a scientific level either this thing doesn't exist or it does exist.
Wow, very, very interesting. Yeah, you know, I, doing research on my own with UFOs, I started to run into Bigfoot accounts not long after I started doing research, and I have to tell you, David, I kind of threw them out. I was very skeptical. I didn't believe in Bigfoot. I thought to myself, well, if there's this large of a creature roaming around, surely science would have discovered it and admitted it. We would have a body. We would have all this stuff. And of course, I was wrong. I had not examined the evidence, and I did find out that you're right. There's mountains of evidence. But so my question to you is, I mean, how did you get involved into this subject? Like I said, I don't think it's paranormal. No,
it's definitely not paranormal. I mean, we have not taken that angle with it, and we are not actively researching that angle. Even though what I tell everybody is that no matter what angle you throw at us, we're not going to discount it on its face. We'll look into all sightings and all aspects. And I think if a researcher from the very beginning starts to throw out certain angles of a topic, then they're truly not a researcher. They're going after their own agenda, and that is not us. Now, one of the things that got us involved is I had 20 years of law enforcement experience, and then after that I went into the technology field and I ran HR organizations in different technology companies. One of these times I was sitting around a table with a group of technology leaders from Silicon Valley, and we were just all talking. And we knew that a couple of us had gone to the woods the previous weekend, and one of the guys says, "Hey, anything ever strange happened to you guys out in the woods?" And when I was 23, I was with a group of veterinary students, three of them from UC Davis, and we were up near the Klamath River. We're sleeping on a ridgeline in Siskiyou County, and we hadn't been drinking, hadn't been using anything odd, and we were watching some UFOs just zip across the skyline from one edge of the horizon to the other. And they were doing this in seconds, and they were covering hundreds of miles, and we watched this for 3 hours, and we were just baffled by what we saw. And so I kind of threw in what I saw, and I said, "Hey, I was with guys that had a science background. We couldn't figure it out." And one thing led to another, and over the course of the next couple of weeks, these guys who are very prominent in the valley says, "Hey, I saw Bigfoot." And then a couple of weeks later, another guy says, "Well, since we're all being honest, I saw it too." Wow. And that's kind of how it all got started. And eventually they came to me and they said, "Dave, you have the background, you have the organizational skills, you have the investigative experience to put together a high-level team, and really let's solve this. Is it a hoax? Is it something from another world? Is it a real entity? What are the truths? What are the lies? Let's get to the ground level and figure this out." And that was almost 6 years ago now.
Wow. Now, here's my question. I mean, new species are being discovered every year. Why are people so reluctant to accept the evidence for Bigfoot? Why is there such skepticism? Why has it been relegated to this, you know, to shows like mine instead of, you know, universities?
Well, I think one of the issues is that people from the academic world have been reluctant to step forward and put grants in place and get academic backing on research to do it at that higher level. And what you've seen are the people who have wanted publicity, have gone out front with various hoaxes, and many times some of these fringe researchers have promised, "Hey, we have this in a jail cell somewhere, you know, and we're going to bring it out in 2 weeks, blah, blah, blah." This has happened so many times. There have been so many false starts that society as a whole starts to think that they're all just a bunch of con men, and there is no reality to this. And unfortunately, it hasn't risen to the level it needs to be to get the credentialed people into place to give it the kind of visibility in that academic setting that's needed. Now, there have been some. Jeff Meldrum from Idaho State's put his credentials on the line and said, "Hey, this is a real being," and various others, but it's very few and far between. And one thing about our organization that we said a long time ago from the very beginning, as a matter of fact, is that we will promise small, but we'll deliver big. And you're not going to see us making a lot of big statements on your show, unfortunately, Preston, or in any others, but whatever we will say, we will back it up. And I think that's happened already, and it will happen in the future. And kind of that's the layout and the landscape and the rationale behind why Bigfoot is in the place it is in the world.
All right. Well, I personally think there's enough evidence in the public arena to conclusively to conclude that Bigfoot is real. So what is the stand of your organization in terms of the amount of evidence that you guys have collected?
Well, I mean, we have scat, we have tracks, we have hair, and up until just the last 18 months, hair has provided some interesting issues to science about the extraction of DNA. And it's only been just recently that there's been a higher level of extraction kits available where you can pull DNA from hair, where there's certain inhibitors in the hair, such as there are in Bigfoot hair. And these extraction kits weren't available like they are today. So I think what you're going to see is an acceleration of the science behind Bigfoot, and you are going to see some genetic coding that will come out probably, I'm going to guess, within the next 18 months that'll prove at a scientific level that Bigfoot does exist.
It's pretty exciting. I've seen, you know, in that show Monster Quest, there was a case that they were talking about in Canada, I believe, where they were able to take some samples of blood and do genetic testing as well with the hair. And I know that some of these samples seem to show a cross between primate and human. Is that correct?
Well, I think that it's going to show that it's way on that human side of the genetic coding.
Oh, interesting. Wow. So what does that say about the intelligence of Bigfoot? Are we dealing with an animal or something that's, you know, as smart as us?
Well, what I tell people is that there are people in our society that are more animalistic than some of the animals in the forests of the woods of the world.
Right.
And I think everyone kind of understands what I'm saying. There are bad, bad people in the world, just like there are bad, bad creatures in the world. And every once in a while, there's going to be an alpha male in the world that just goes askew and does things that are completely irrational. And if that can happen on the human side of the equation, then it sure can happen on and in any other breed of animals in the world. And I think that has happened before, and it'll continue to happen.
Right, right. Very interesting. So is your research concentrated then mostly in Northern California, in that area? Or?
Well, originally what we did is we did a map of the western U.S., and we accumulated sightings and encounters from as many sources as we could find on the Internet, from John Green, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And we placed these on a map of the western U.S. It took us about 6 months to do it in a very fine way. And it eventually came down to Northern California as the most optimum location to start a research project. And we siphoned it down to an area in Humboldt County called the Hoopa Reservation. And it's 12 by 12 square miles. It's the largest Indian reservation in Northern California. And just by coincidence, it's miles away from Bluff Creek. And it straddles, essentially. The Trinity River flows right through the middle of the Hoopa Reservation. The Klamath River is very close. The Karuk and the Yurok Reservation is also very close to this. And it's in the middle of several different wilderness areas in those regions. So we placed ourselves in there for 2 years. It took a while to get the trust of the elders and the people in the community, because other documentary people have come in and verbally rape the people for their knowledge and then embarrass them in a public setting with what they found. So people were a little reluctant to come forward to somebody who's claiming to be doing honest research on Bigfoot. After a while, they understood us, they understood what we wanted, they started to come forward, and what happened was that we found that probably only 10% of the sightings in an area are ever reported. 90% are never reported. And unless you go out and knock on the door, gain their credibility, and then they'll start to talk to you. So what I tell people is if there's 2,000 recorded sightings in the U.S. of Bigfoot, there's probably 20,000 actual sightings.
Wow. Same thing happens with UFOs. Same exact phenomena. It's vastly unreported, any estimates of how much is going on. So,
oh, sure.
Very, very interesting. So what does that say about the possible number, the population of Bigfoot? I mean, we have Bigfoot coming down here, and I'm here in the San Fernando Valley outside Los Angeles, right outside L.A., in the L.A. forest. I'm getting a bunch of reports. So
yes.
all over, and it's just surprising to me how close they come to urban centers at times. I'm wondering how many of these creatures do you think there are out there?
Well, we've heard guesstimates of anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000 across the U.S. I know that in Northern California, there have been guesstimates in that four-county, Siskiyou, Del Norte, Humboldt, and Trinity counties, upwards of 200 were given by an anthropologist that went up there and did a study. The reality of it is we don't know. But the truth is that, and this is a definite fact, is that Bigfoot has been observing us much, much, much longer than we have the availability to witness it. And they have an acute sense of interest in humans, specifically kids and women. It appears that they have very little fear of kids specifically. And many times people don't understand that they're being viewed by a Bigfoot, but they probably are many more times than not when you're deep in the woods and you have that sixth sense that something's watching you. Yeah, it could be a Bigfoot.
Very, very interesting. Now, the Hooper Project, this is your first book. That's the result of your two-year-long investigation into that area?
Yeah, 2 years we were there. We gained many, many witnesses to it. But when we started the project, even in its infancy, we wanted to understand exactly what we were dealing with. And if you look back in the literature, which we did, and we read just about every book available on the topic, there's many titles, the Great American Ape, the Apes of the American Northwest. The word ape is in the literature many, many times. And when people have a sighting of a Bigfoot at 100, 200 yards away, you see a big, tall, hairy, monstrous thing running on 2 feet across the woods. You don't get to see its face. You really don't get an up-close look. You don't really know how long the hair is. But you see this big thing that's kind of bent over. It doesn't have great posture. And that's a vast, vast majority of the sightings. And until you get down into the minutiae and you start to really talk to people and you start digging for the people that have had the good sightings, meaning, say, 20 feet or less where you could describe facial features, this is where we wanted to go with this from the beginning to understand what we're dealing with. We never were going to hunt this thing, but in a sense we are hunting. We're hunting for information to understand, but never to kill, never to harm, and never to capture. And I know as a hunter, you need to understand what you're hunting before you go out. And what we did is because of my law enforcement background, I had dealt with forensic artists in the past and how valuable a tool that is. And so we did a national search for the best forensic artist we could find, and we ended up finding an individual in Oklahoma City. He's a former assistant director for the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation. His name is Harvey Pratt. And he still is the predominant forensic artist throughout the state of Oklahoma. Harvey is so good that when he sits down with a witness and he interviews them and draws a sketch of what this person observed, say it's a teller in a bank, somebody comes in and robs the bank and it gets away, and the person's eventually captured, it would almost appear as the person was sitting there when Harvey drew the sketch. That's how good he is.
Wow.
So we brought Harvey into Hoopa for a week, and he sat down with many of our witnesses, and he drew sketches of the face and the body of what we were dealing with. And Preston, I can tell you for a fact that at the end of that first day, we sat down in a room alone, completely stunned about what we had drawn.
Really? Wow. Why is that?
Well, we can only go by all the literature that existed at the time, and the literature all says apes, apes, apes. And many of the academic people are saying, hey, it's got to be a Gigantopithecus, it's got to be an ape family. And all of our sketches turned out much more human in the facial qualities than anything close to being an ape. And when I debriefed the people after Harvey was done, one of the common questions I'd say is that if you had a picture of what you observed sitting in front of you, and that represented 10 out of 10 of what you saw, tell me what the sketch represents to you that Harvey just completed. Is this a 5 out of 10, a 6 out of 10? And 99% of the time, people would say, no, that's a 10 out of 10. That's exactly what I saw.
Wow. What's the artist's name again?
Well, he's not an artist. His name is Harvey Pratt. He's a forensic artist. And it's good you said that because I want to explain the difference on this. an artist uses their own interpretive skills and their own angle on something to draw a sketch, a person, a portrait. But a forensic artist only draws to the instructions of the person who made the observation. It's a very finite skill, and not everybody has it. And I'll explain is that there's another organization out there that uses an artist, and the artist calls the witness, and the witness describes over the phone to this other organization's artist what they observed. And then at the end of a half an hour, 45 minutes, the artist will fax the sketch back to the witness, and they'll talk again in another week. And this will go back four or five times. And this other organization's artist, I've seen the work, everything looks like an ape. Well, we were in Texas for the Texas Bigfoot Conference last year, and we had Harvey's sketches, several of them laying on the table. This young adult came in, looked at the sketches, and just stared and yelled across the room for his mom to come over, and she had to see this. And he explained to us that he had been dealing with this other organization's artist, and he gave up after faxing the sketch back and forth five times, explaining that what this person observed wasn't an ape, wasn't anything close to an ape, was more human. And he kept getting sketches back that looked like an ape.
Isn't that amazing?
And he said, you guys have got it right. This is what it looks like.
Wow. Yeah, I'm looking at the sketch on your website, or one of them. And that definitely looks like a hairy man, really, like more not an ape, like you're saying, human eyes especially. So, very, very interesting. And you were able to use his sketches in your books as well.
Absolutely. We contracted him to do the work. And part of this is an educational process to get the public to understand really what's out there. And rather than sending people out to go shoot this thing, let's get an understanding going of what we're dealing with. This thing's intelligent. It's generally passive. It's nothing that we want to shoot.
You know, I did research. I collected all the accounts I could find in California, and there's a number of cases, not only in California, of course, but across the United States and the world, where people have shot at a Bigfoot. And I couldn't find a single case where anyone was actually able to bring it down. Why do you suppose guns seem to be so ineffectual? Because some of these cases take place at close range.
Well, I think part of the answer to that is that generally these things are between 7 and 8.5 feet tall, and people grossly underestimate the weight because this thing is massively muscular, and muscle weighs much more than fat. And these things are probably weighing anywhere between 1,000 and 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 pounds at 7 to 8 feet tall. They're huge. And most of the time, the weapons you hear about that they're getting shot with are 22s, maybe a 25, maybe a 30-30. Every once in a while, you hear a 30-06. Well, when you hear about a 30-06, unless it's in the head, you know, it's not going to drop something right away. Even a deer doesn't go down right away most times with a 30-06. Sometimes, but not always. And with this thing, it's our belief that many times they travel with others. You may only see one, but there's others in the background.
Oh, interesting.
And because they have a thinking pattern that's much different than what most people understand, I think they come to the aid of each other. And if one goes down or something happens, I think they're coming to the aid and they're taking them away.
So this would explain why there's no bodies. No,
correct.
No fossil evidence. Interesting. Well, I mean, it's my understanding that there's not fossil evidence of creatures that we already accept in science. So I think this is, so let's get into some of the more interesting cases that you've been on. Can you tell us like a story about someone who saw a Bigfoot or what they saw?
There have been some very unusual cases. I'll step back and say that the name of our second book, Tribal Bigfoot, kind of how it got to that, and then I'll take the understanding to a different level, is we did research and we found two articles that were written in 1926 up in the northwestern U.S., printed in the Oregonian newspaper. And it talks about a group of three Native American tribes that got together, and they held a press conference, and they told the world that they understood that there was a posse of white men that were getting together that were going to go out and hunt this creature. And they said, first of all, you got to understand it's not a creature. It's another tribe of Native Americans. Oh. And these people have a language. They speak with us. They look different. Sometimes they think differently, but they communicate and they have a family core, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this was in 1926, and to get three Native American tribes to agree to anything was huge. But if you can remember how the American public treated the Native Americans in the early part of the 20th century, it wasn't very good. And they were ridiculed and they were embarrassed. And for these groups to come together and risk further ridicule and embarrassment and to come out and say these things was huge. But they did because they were the ones that lived with them in that environment. So keeping that mindset and taking that forward and understanding that as you look and you understand this topic across the U.S., you'll start to notice that the predominant amount of the sightings occur very near reservations as you march across the U.S. Of course, they spread out and they go to other areas and they move and they migrate, but a lot of the sightings are around other Native American reservations. And why is that? And I think it's number one, understood that other Native Americans would never shoot at them. Number two, they've lived together for hundreds of years. And number three, it's a safe environment for them to stay in. Right. But the sightings, in the Tribal Bigfoot book, we did an entire section on Oklahoma and another section on Minnesota, a lot on California. And it's a consistent theme as you go across the U.S. that other Native American tribes have it passed down from the elders saying, hey, if you ever are faced with one, you talk to it in your native tongue and they understand.
Oh, wow.
And that was an amazing fact that we heard as we went across the U.S. from different tribes.
Well, I haven't heard that before. That's very interesting. I know that there are some cases where people have heard allegedly them speaking, but I could only find like 5, maybe 10, where people have heard words coming from them. So that's very interesting. That's very, very interesting.
Well, a sighting that was recorded in the Hoopa Project occurred on the periphery of a reservation. A man was in his house, and he heard some chatter in the backyard. So he got up and he walked across his lawn and kind of looked down the hill into some big scrub oaks that were on the hillside, and he saw two Bigfoot. One he thought was a female large, and one was like a young teenager type Bigfoot. And he said as he looked over the side, they were talking back and forth to each other. And he told me, he said, Dave, he goes, I could almost understand what they were saying, but the language was so fast and so quick, it was like maybe every 10th word there was something very close to our own native language that I could understand. And that is a pretty consistent theme about their language. And on our website, which is nabigfootsearch.com, there's a report that's written by a cryptolinguist expert that had worked for the armed forces in the U.S., deciphering different things regarding language. And he wrote up a very long report about Bigfoot language. And there was something, a recording made about Bigfoot up in the Sierra Nevadas a number of years ago where it was reported it was language. That tape was submitted to this individual, and he wrote a grand report. And it's very technical. It's on our site if you want to read it. But essentially he said that the flow, the verbiage, the way things are set down, it's very fast speech, but it's definitely language.
Well, that's interesting. Well, that fits in with the whole primate family. And, you know, it's my understanding that these Bigfoot do all kinds of vocalizations, including whistling and screaming at very high-pitched noises. And I actually spoke with a witness who described all this stuff to me. She had an amazing encounter in Acton, right outside the LA National Forest. And it just went on and on. She described pretty much all the stuff you hear. And she said one night she woke up and she heard a banging on the roof and was too afraid to go outside and went out the next morning and there was a boulder on top of her roof that, you know, no man could lift. She asked me, Preston, you know, it's not possible that this thing is trying to kidnap me, is it? I'm like, oh, no, there's no kidnapping stories at all in the literature. that was before I had actually surveyed, you know, all the literature, and I found like, you know, 5 or 10 kidnapping cases. So this thing can potentially be hostile. Is that true?
You know, there are a lot of people out there who don't want to believe it, but in tribal Bigfoot, we found a woman named Lucy that wrote a book in the early 1900s. She was a Yurok Native American woman living on the Klamath Woman River, and she cited a series of stories where something that was described as the Indian Devil, and the Indian Devil known to the Hoopa people today is Bigfoot, and would come down and while the warriors were out during the day hunting and doing things, and the women were in camp alone. They would come down occasionally and just take a woman away. Sometimes she'd come back, sometimes she wouldn't. There's a story in tribal Bigfoot. Well, one of the things I encourage my people to do that I don't know another group that does is to go out and knock on doors. And what I mean by that is that if we have a sighting in a specific area, get out a USGS map and find the 4 or 5 homes that are closest to that location and go out and knock on those cabins' doors. Leave a note for them. Leave your business card, something, and get back to them. Well, there was a sighting near Dillon Creek in the near the Klamath River up in northern Siskiyou County area. And I was driving along, and there was a house next to the river, very old house, and it had rock stacks, rocks on top of rocks on top of rocks in front of the house. And some people have claimed that that's an indicative item that Bigfoot does in the woods, meaning something, nobody quite knows what, but I saw these in front of the house, and it was close enough to Dillon. I pulled over, knocked on the door, and this Native family came out, and there were some quite older people in this group, and I engaged them in a conversation, explained who I was. They were very, very polite people, and they said that they'd lived in this house along the Klamath for 200 years. And I asked them, well, has anybody here ever seen a Bigfoot? Do you have any Bigfoot experiences? And to me, the entire aura of this family reeked of credibility, because if somebody wanted to engage me at some level, they could say, oh, yeah, we've seen Bigfoot a bunch of times. Is that not one person in the family ever said they saw a Bigfoot. But what they did tell me was that in the early 1900s, they had a niece that came up from the city, and it was the coast. It was either Eureka or Crescent City, and I don't remember which. And she came up for the summer to spend with the family, and one of the first days she was there, they were sitting in the house, and they decided to visit another family in another house on the other side of the Klamath, which borders what is now the Marble Mountain Wilderness area. And they, at that time of the year, the Klamath was slow, and they rode the boat across, and there were 3 girls, and two of the girls said, okay, we're going to go over to the house, and this one girl that was new says, hey, I'm going to go over to this huckleberry bush and pick some huckleberries for the family as a gift. They said, okay. Anyhow, the girl went over to the bush, wasn't seen again. And the girls got together with the tribe, and they got together 100 warriors, and they searched for 3 weeks and found nothing. And in the middle of the 4th week, the girl comes back, and she's tattered, she's in ruins, staggers back into camp, and she says, hey, I was taken by this big hairy man and held for 3 weeks.
Wow.
And they said that she was mentally completely drained, and she was frazzled. And they said, you know, we've heard strange things, we've smelled strange things, we've never seen it, but ever since then we've been very, very cautious. We never let a girl go out alone.
Wow. I know Jeff Meldrum collected several stories of Native Americans who had told him that they had stories of where babies were taken from teepees, where hands would come in and take the babies as well. So apparently they're, wow. So, well, this leads me to another question that's, well, not really related, but it's something I've always wondered about, is this smell of Bigfoot. And what's your take on that? It's my understanding that it only turns up in 10, 15, 20% of the cases?
Yeah, it's not in every case by any means, and I would compare it to, if anybody has spent time in an urban setting, and specifically in a bad urban setting where there's people that are down and out and are filthy and dirty, and you walk through that area and you make some some notations about some of the smells in that area. They're not too good. And Bigfoot is hairy. It's big. It's in the woods. You know, maybe hygiene isn't at the top of the world's order for this biped. And the odors associated with it are consistent with the odors that you'd find on a dirty person. And sometimes those odors are associated with, I've heard it described as a cross between an old oil drum and a skunk and feces. And just the general descriptions I've heard, I could honestly say I've smelled those things in some of the places I've worked.
So you don't think that there's anything to the theory that these things, like skunks, are able to emit smell at will to repel people?
Well, I'm not here to say that that doesn't occur, because I don't know. But I can say that there could be logic behind it that is a rational reason why we're smelling this sometimes.
Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting. You know, I always assumed it was that Bigfoot always smells, but apparently no. So I just find it fascinating that we don't, you know, that it's inconsistent. Well, here's another question for you then. What would you consider is the best evidence that this is, in fact, a real creature? I mean, is it the hair, is it the footprints, or is it
Right now, I definitely say hair, just because there's these new kits that are out there that can extract DNA where it was nearly impossible before. That coupled with, I know that there's been some conjecture out there that the dermal ridges that are found in some of the prints aren't valid. I don't believe that. I think some of the information that's been gathered by Jimmy Chilcott in Texas, he's a police technician, and what he's found I think is very valuable. And essentially that's the fingerprint of the foot, and he's found these in some of the casts that were made in the 60s. And essentially that is impossible to forge. So I think that's valuable, and I honestly have to believe at this point that the number of sketches that we've done, and we did probably almost 70 forensic sketches before the first book ever came out, that the consistency in the facial descriptions is so astounding that if somebody was going to draw something and try to appease us and get us to believe, they would have drawn something that looked like the Patterson-Gimlin creature, but people didn't. They drew something that looks much, much more human, which told us that, you know, this thing is out there. People were credible, and they drew what they actually saw.
Right. So, in effect, it's an amalgamation of all the evidence, then, I think. I mean, in my opinion, that's putting it all together, I don't see how anyone can come up with any other explanation. And as far as hoaxes, I mean, is it possible to pull off a hoax, you think, with footprints across the United States like this?
Oh, I think that there were some great hoaxes that have gone on over the years, and I mean, some that really baffled some people, but one man or two men, or I don't even think 20 men could come up and do what we've seen in just our research. I can tell you that I've been with another researcher in the middle of nowhere in the Siskiyou wilderness area. I honestly didn't quite know where I was at the time, and absolute blistering, horrible weather, and we're walking along a stream area 20 feet away on an old washed out road, and they're coming down the hillside to our right, something massive, and it put one track right in the middle of this old road, and it kept going towards the river, and there was just no way that it was anything but a Bigfoot. That was pretty huge corner to turn for us. I mean, when we saw this, we said there's had to have been done in the last 12 hours because of the weather, and it was just an amazing sight.
Right. So do we have any idea where these guys are hanging out? I mean, I'm assuming that they have dwellings or something. I mean, do we know anything about where they live?
Well, I do believe that Siskiyou, Humboldt, Trinity, and Del Norte counties and the southern coastal regions of Oregon are high areas of Bigfoot activity. I think that those probably are the areas where Bigfoot originally probably established themselves, and from those locations outward, other groups migrated to live. But I do think that there's still the highest density of population there. Now, where are they? I think they're probably very close to us and on a routine basis, but a couple of things to understand. The thing's 10 times stronger than a human, and it's easily 5 times faster than any human, because there are many times that we've taken a sighting report and the guy says, hey, I was going 35 miles an hour and the thing was right next to the car.
Yeah, well, that's another thing I wanted to ask you. How fast can they move, actually? Because I heard reports of up to 60 miles an hour.
The most that I've ever seen documented where I could actually say it's credible was 35.
Right. Well, you know, I think that's entirely possible, considering one of their legs is, what, the size of a person. I found a case where one person said it, sitting down, it was 6 feet tall, the creature he came upon.
Right.
So these things are, I think, like you were saying, a lot larger than people realize. So in your book, Tribal Bigfoot, it looks like you cover quite a number of areas. In Minnesota as well?
What we did is we tried to lay a roadmap for the reader, a common sense roadmap to get to the conclusions that we're at today.
Uh-huh.
That being that, yeah, there's a very good chance this is some type of family, tribal activity that's gone on for hundreds of years. We included several articles from the early 1800s, some written by explorers that have had sightings as they came across the U.S. There's a notation in there about a religious person that had a sighting coming across the U.S. That coupled with, you know, sightings from Minnesota, sightings from Oklahoma, sightings from the U.S., what's the common thread between them? The different tribes came out and said routinely, hey, these people are part of us.
Wow. Very interesting. Well, it's quite a large book, 480 pages, wow, 50 interviews, signed affidavits. People are serious about what they're seeing then. And it's published by Hancock House, who's been publishing a lot of these books on Bigfoot for quite some time.
Well, when we first started this, we wanted to make sure that the people took this as serious as we took it. And so we told people from the beginning that we'll be glad to take your statement, but we're going to have you sign an affidavit to your sighting if you want us to investigate it. As far as I know, right now we're the only group that's doing this. And part of that is to just make sure that the statement's correct, that we're keeping a consistent path on the way we take reports and the way we document this. And we don't want the people to say later on, hey, we didn't get a chance to review it. No, review it, sign it, make any changes you need to make, et cetera.
Right. Very interesting. Well, everyone, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett. And tonight, our guest is David Paulides. He's the executive director of North America Bigfoot Search. His website, if you want more information, is www.nabigfootsearch.com. NABigfootSearch, all one word, .com. Very interesting website. Lots of information there. I encourage you all to take a look at it after the show, and I think you'll find it very fascinating. Now, David, another question I have is, what kind of a technology and equipment do you bring to your research? I know that, you know, with the advent of the video camera, a lot of people are getting a lot more astounding footage of all kinds of things, UFOs, ghosts, and what have you. So I imagine it's only a matter of time before people get some really conclusive video of Bigfoot and audio recordings. So how are you working in that direction?
I think we probably are a lot different than many groups out there in that specific aspect of the Bigfoot arena. I've told our people, and we've had meetings about this, that a primary target for us is not to go out there and get the best video footage in the world. I do believe that there are some habituators out there right now that are having Bigfoot visiting them on a regular basis where this opportunity may present itself if done correctly. The chances of us going into the field and capturing something for a few seconds that's going to offer us a new insight into this biped that wasn't known before is probably not going to happen. So I think our time is better used in other arenas. If you can think that the best footage in the last 45 years is still the Patterson-Gimlin footage, with all the advances and all the video that's out there, that's the best we have. So why would I think that we could do better than that? I don't think we could. And I don't think that that video is going to prove to anybody that that thing exists or not. It'll just cause more controversy.
Yeah, that's a big problem with photographic evidence these days. It's very easy to fake.
Correct.
And for that matter, the Patterson footage has come under constant attack. Though I find the case convincing with all the footprint evidence that took place around there and the other sightings beyond his alone.
Yeah. Well, we've been very, very lucky. I spent a day with Patricia Patterson. She opened herself up to me. And I will tell you that she is a very, very sweet person, a very honest person, and someone who I think is somewhat victimized by this, by the world ridicule, because she really had nothing to do with it, and she really harbors no new information that could glean anything additional to this topic. But we have recently, our organization recently came into either a first or a second generation copy of the Patterson-Gimlin film, and it's a full frame copy. And we have some experts looking at it as we speak. And there's new additional footage that is available because it is a full frame that hasn't been seen before. Now, Mrs. Patterson, when I was with her, she allowed me to look at five transparencies that Roger did in the early 70s of five frames of the film. We scanned it at the highest resolution it's ever been scanned at. And we examined those. And I can tell you that by looking at those, there's absolutely no doubt they captured a real Bigfoot on film.
Wow. That's very, very interesting. Yeah, I've always thought that that case was one of the groundbreaking cases, and it's odd that no one else has been able to capture footage, like you say, that's as long or convincing, for that matter.
But I'll give you a few other things, Preston, that are odd about that footage. That 90 or 95% of all the sketches we've done of facial Bigfoots, 90 to 95% don't have the facial hair that that creature has.
Huh.
And 80% of all the sightings are of a male Bigfoot, but that's a female.
Right. Very bizarre.
So to think that they got that length of footage of a female with that amount of facial hair, when you start to understand how unbelievable those odds were, how lucky they were to catch that there,
right.
It's pretty unreal.
Wow. So do we know anything about the diet of Bigfoot? Are these things carnivorous? Are they vegetarians or omnivorous?
Yeah, they're omnivores. They're opportunists. They will probably eat just about anything. We've had several reports where they've gone into dumps, into dumpsters, into garbage cans. One of the best hair samples that we've ever had came out of a sighting in Hoopa where it reached over a tin shed that was acting as a garbage shed, and its hair came off on the side of the tin shed as it was picking up garbage bags to take away.
Wow. Very interesting. Yeah, I spoke with a lady who was went on a ride-along with a police officer. This was up in the Bakersfield area, around there. And they were called out by a lady who said that there was a bear or some type of animal going through their dumpster every night, and it was back again. And they rode out there. And this lady, Kate, I did actually a couple of interviews with her, said that she and the police officer stepped out, and this thing that was in front of the dumpster turned around, and it was, 6.5 feet, almost 7 feet tall, covered with hair and had a human-looking face, like you said, and was a male Bigfoot. And the woman came running out of her house and shot a gun into the air and scared it away. And they tried to run after it, but it very, very quickly eluded them. So it seems in some cases these things are not afraid of being seen, or just kind of, I don't know, it's bizarre. Sometimes it seems they're very elusive, and other times they're right in your face.
There's much inconsistency when you talk about Bigfoot, and an individual named Ray Crow, who's been doing Bigfoot research for decades. We bought his research when he retired a couple years ago, and I had a talk with Ray about this one time. And he said, "Dave, remember your dad telling you when you were a kid that as you get older, you realize really how little you know about things in the world?" And he says, "Dave, as you get into Bigfoot, you realize that things that you thought would make sense really don't make sense. And when about the time you think that there's consistency to the topic, there's no consistency." And I can honestly say that he is right.
You know, another thing that baffles me is, you know, I'm primarily a UFO researcher. At least that's how I got involved in this field. And some of the witnesses that were telling me about Bigfoot said it appeared during or immediately after or before a UFO sighting. And after surveying the literature, I see that there's the connection, if it's there at all, it's extremely loose because it's only in less than 1% of the cases. So I just wondered what you thought about, you know, some of these types of reports.
Well, a lot of people don't know this, and this would be a groundbreaking day for Preston, but years ago, I was a MUFON investigator.
Oh, all right. Wow.
And it got to that because of some things I saw in the sky, and I had law enforcement experience. I was a detective, so I thought I'd apply some of those skills. And when I started to read the literature about UFOs, and I don't remember the name of the professor from, was it Harvard, that wrote a book about abductions?
John Mack. Right.
John Mack, right. So if you start to apply logic to this and you say, okay, let's say that the aliens are coming down and they're abducting humans and they're doing tests on us or they're doing something odd on us, why wouldn't they want to do the same sort of testing on a Bigfoot creature running around that they would be doing on us?
Perhaps.
And there's an interesting story I cite in Tribal Bigfoot, and I don't draw these analogies or these comparisons because I don't see the evidence for it right now. But there is some, like you said, there are some stories floating around. And a city called Hyampom in Trinity County, it's really a very isolated region of the county. A forestry crew was on a ridgeline, and it was late in the summer. It was about 8 o'clock at night. It was still fairly starting to get dusk, but it was cool, and they worked from noon till 8 when their work got tough because they didn't want to do it in the heat of the day. They were on this ridgeline, and they see this UFO fly up the valley. And they described it similar to an orb. And it flew up the valley, and it stopped between their position and the mountain on the other side, and they guesstimated they weren't more than a quarter to a half a mile from it. And it was dusk in the valley area. There were deep shadows, and this thing kind of moved towards the tree line, this forestry man said, who was the manager of this area. And he said it lit up the entire hillside that was under shadows like it was looking for something. And he said, "Dave, the unbelievable part of this was is that this forestry guy was talking to me about Bigfoot. He says, but that was the area the month earlier where we had Bigfoot sightings." So I put that in the book, not because I'm trying to draw the correlation, just I ran into this story, and like you said, every once in a while, there is this correlation.
Right, and you can't throw away the evidence. I mean, that's not going to help solve any mysteries. I think it's important to at least consider, like you said, what people are seeing or saying they're seeing.
And, you know, it took some guts for this guy who worked for the government to say what this entire team of people saw. So it sounded very credible.
So we've got like 5 more minutes. I want to make sure we have enough time for you to wrap up any areas we haven't covered and, you know, let us know what the future you think of a Bigfoot research is and where you hope you're to take your organization and what we might accomplish, you know, what will we ever have the proof of Bigfoot? Will one ever be captured? Should we try to capture one?
No, I don't think we should ever try to capture one. I think if we do our work and we do our scientific research, I think that we won't need to do this. I do believe that in the next 18 months, there's going to be some huge revelations. But one thing I would like everyone who's listening to this to do is, when they get a chance, look at that four-county region of Northern California, Trinity, Del Norte, Humboldt, and Siskiyou. There's more sightings per population in Del Norte County than anywhere else in the western U.S. And it's a very small county. Well, what we did is we produced what's called the Northern California Bigfoot Map, and it's that four-county area that I just described. And we entered into a licensing agreement with California State AAA, and it's their driving map with sightings and encounters placed on it on one side and a description of each incident on the other. There's 350 of them in that four-county area. I've presented this map to umpteen dozen people, and I say, I want you to study this, and you tell me what you can decipher from it. And the same way that an everyday citizen deciphered the Zodiac letter for San Francisco Police Department, I hope somebody can decipher why these sightings and incidents are in the places they are on these maps. Because we've had some of the best in the world look at it, and the one thing we can decipher is 80% of the sightings are within 10 miles of a river, and 80% are within 40 miles of the coast. And that's about all we know. Now, you can get a copy of the map through our website. I would encourage you to do it. Take a drive around up there. It's a fascinating, beautiful region. All of the sightings on those maps are in both books. So both the books, all the sightings and encounters are listed on the map, so you can kind of get a flow for what's going on. And keep an open mind on the topic, and believe me that the more you research and you understand this, the more you'll start to understand it's a real issue. It is a real biped.
Oh, I agree. I'm absolutely convinced. All I really needed to do was look at the evidence, and like I think it's overwhelming. And it's interesting you mapped out all these sightings, because I know they did that in Texas. Someone did, and the preponderance of the sightings was on the eastern side, which it turns out is the much wetter half of the state.
Exactly.
That would tie in with exactly what your research is showing there. Fascinating stuff, really fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
So let me see, your two books again are The Hoopa Project and Tribal Bigfoot, which are both published by Hancock Books, is that right?
Hancock House Publication, you can get them both through our website as well.
And the website is nabigfootsearch.com, right? All one word?
That's it, Preston.
Awesome. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It's really been quite interesting, and I learned a lot. I thought I was pretty well educated on Bigfoot, but you definitely taught me a few things. So I want to thank you for that, and really just keep up the good work.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show, Preston.
All right. Well, everyone, that is our show tonight. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest tonight has been David Paulides. He's the executive director of the North America Bigfoot Search. It's a scientific investigation dedicated to finding evidence and studying the evidence available of Bigfoot. And if you want to find out more information about North America Bigfoot Search, go to their website, www.nabigfootsearch.com, where you can find all sorts of stories, maps, sketches from forensic artists, as well as how to get David Paulides' books, The Hoopa Project and Tribal Bigfoot. That's it. I want to thank you all for listening, and I hope you can join us next week when we bring on another exciting guest on UFOs and the Paranormal on the BBS Network. Thank you all for listening, and have a great week.